This is KOOP HD1 HD3 Hornsby. Welcome to Civil Rights and Wrongs, the state of your civil liberties in the Lone Star State. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of the co-op board of directors, staff, volunteers, or underwriters. The following program is homecrafted and was recorded on May 21st. In an opinion essay that appeared a few weeks ago in the Austin Chronicle, Cutter Gonzalez discusses the matter of eminent domain. Gonzalez points out that the state of Texas grants common carrier privilege to private pipeline operators, such as Kinder Morgan, the developer of the Permian Highway Pipeline. Common carrier has traditionally connoted transportation, communications, and public utility companies. This means that Kinder Morgan may purchase easements up to 100 feet wide along the path of the pipeline, with or without the consent of the property owners. The issue is seen as a call to arms in the Hill Country. Pipeline opponents argue vociferously that common carrier status must be repealed from pipeline developers. Gonzalez argues that Texas could build a coalition of environmentalists and property rights advocates, two groups that have not always been on the same side. He concludes that eminent domain reform is a coalition-building issue that allows us to protect our environment and the rights of Texas landowners simultaneously. The Permian Highway Pipeline proves this point. With greater property rights protections, an idea at the core of Texas political identity, we can meet the concerns of property owners and environmentalists alike. Good evening and welcome to Civil Rights and Wrongs on Co-op 91.7 in Austin, streaming through koop.org. I'm your host, Bob Daly. Our guest this evening is David Baker, Executive Director of the Wimberley Valley Watershed Association, or WVWA. Their vision is a future with clean, plentiful water and a healthy ecosystem essential to the culture and economy of the Wimberley Valley. We also have Patrick Cox, Executive Director of the Trinity Edwards Springs Protection Association, or TESPA. Their mission is to protect the Trinity and Edwards aquifers and to protect the landowners who depend on this precious natural resource. Good evening, David and Patrick. Could you tell us a little about yourselves and the organizations that you represent? Let's start with David.
Thank you, Bob. Thanks for having us tonight. The Wimberley Valley Watershed Association was founded in 1996, and our mission is to protect the water quality, quantity, Jacobs Well, Cypress Creek, Blanco River. We have work in several different impact areas. We're a land trust, so we conserve land and have conserved all over 300 acres around Jacobs Well. We do watershed protection and conservation science. We do environmental planning, policy and advocacy, which we'll be talking about today, and the Texas Hill Country Conservation Network, as well as an education outreach program. So we're really busy these days with all the threats to the Hill Country, and we're really happy about this partnership with TESPA.
Okay, well, and then Patrick, tell us about TESPA and yourself.
Oh, well, thank you, Bob. And I'll just a few minutes about myself. I'm Patrick Cox, and I'm an historian and author, and have also worked for many years on environmental and conservation issues, and that includes a number of years working with David. I was on the board and president of WVWA for many years. And I've been in this area for almost 50 years now. During that time, I've become concerned, much more interested, and much more motivated to protect this valuable resource that we have in our part of the Hill Country, that being our aquifers and groundwater, as well as our surface water and springs and creeks. That, to a large degree, also coincides with TESPA's mission. It's our organization, the Trinity Edward Springs Protection Association, which we'll talk about as TESPA now. It's a nonprofit organization that's created to protect the Trinity and Edwards aquifers from pumping, pollution, and abuse, and also the property rights of the landowners and the people who rely on our groundwater as a sole source of drinking water.
So there's this pipeline project that's been proposed, and I guess it's currently under construction, that's going to be passing through your areas. It's commonly called the Kinder Morgan Project, but I think technically, isn't it the Permian Highway Project? Is that right?
The Permian Highway Pipeline, yes.
Pipeline, right. Yeah. So this is not the first pipeline to go through Texas, but this one's a bit controversial. Could either of you talk a little about the history of that project and where it's passing and where do things stand at the moment?
This is David Baker. We started working on this. We found out in, I guess, fall of 2018 that Kinder Morgan had planned it's about a 440-mile pipeline from Waha, Texas, in the Permian Basin to Katy, Texas. It would transport 2.1 billion cubic feet of fracked gas out of the Permian. It's a 42-inch pipeline, and it was passing through the heart of the Hill Country, Gillespie County, Blanco, and Hays County, where we are. And it was coming about a mile, 1.3 miles north of Jacobs Well. They're planning to pass underneath the Blanco River, the Pernalis, as well as the Llano. We started our advocacy back then. There were several lawsuits filed by the TRED Coalition. And we think this is just a travesty to put a pipeline of this magnitude through these karst aquifers in the Hill Country, the karst being the fragile limestone that where water infiltrates from the surface back into the groundwater and is the sole source drinking water supply for everyone in the Hill Country. And for San Antonio and Austin, almost 2 million people rely on the Edwards Aquifer, which this pipeline will cross. So we've been adamantly opposed to it. And we'll talk more about the March 28th event where Kinder Morgan was trying to bore under the Blanco River and spilled 36,000 gallons of toxic drilling fluid into the aquifer and contaminated several drinking water wells. And that is what TESPA and WVWA have partnered on to file a lawsuit to protect those landowners, protect the aquifer, and get Kinder Morgan to clean it up and hopefully move that pipeline away from that sensitive area.
So there are currently some lawsuits to at least suspend operations. It sounds like suspend construction, but technically the project is still proceeding. Is that correct?
Yes, it's proceeding in both Blanco and Hays County right now. And this is, of course, our particular interests and our concerns because of this construction that's occurring. It's because of the practices of this company, and we'll get into more of the legal discussion about it, but they are really ignoring not just the law and how this should be constructed according to the permits that they've received from the Corps of Engineers. But also, Bob, it defies common sense and decency as to what we're witnessing. I've been, especially in the last 2 weeks, because I live very close, I'm within 2 miles of the pipeline easement that's coming through the middle of our county. And David and I are both hearing on a daily basis, and I've gone out and witnessed the activities that are going on, that it moves you to tears. It breaks your heart to sit and observe what this clearing of the land, the damage that it's doing, the just destruction of the entire natural area as they clear this easement, and the activities and demeanor of the people that are doing this construction. I think they've been not just inappropriate, it's also been very insulting and hurtful and damaging to all of us in this area.
Well, part of this process is that the pipeline company, and part of the problem we have with these pipelines is that they're only required to get a T4 permit from the Texas Railroad Commission. That's essentially filling out a form, a one-page form, and there is no routing process evaluation. There is no safety guidelines and no observation of the digging and the construction of these pipelines. And in this case, there was the taking of golden cheek warbler habitat. In order to do that, Kinder Morgan had to do consultation with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service about the habitat they were going to take. And they were doing this under the Nationwide 12 permit that the Army Corps of Engineers issued. And in that, there was a biological opinion developed that required Kinder Morgan to not clear these golden cheek warbler habitats between March 1st and the end of August. This is the nesting season for these endangered birds. They have violated that blatantly. They were clearing yesterday on Halifax Ranch, which is right on the Blanco River, has a conservation easement on it, clearing heritage oaks that were 2 and 3 feet across. As Patrick said, it's just a violation, not only of the agreement they made with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, but just with common sense and with decency for what this region represents. They have other options for their pipeline, and we urge them from the very beginning to consider rerouting as the 12 or 13 other pipelines that are being built or being built south of the Edwards Aquifer through those sand aquifers. And it would have been about 40 miles longer for them to do that. But they chose to bore right through this area, ignoring the agreements they had made with the Fish and Wildlife Service. And then if you saw the ruling from Montana a few weeks ago that overturned and suspended the Nationwide 12 permit that they were using for all their 440 some river crossings and stream crossings, that was suspended by federal courts. And we believe that really eliminates Kinder Morgan's permit, and that they should be getting a permit for each of these crossings from the Corps. And when they spilled there and discharged that illegally into the aquifer there in Blanco, they did stop construction there, but it did not stop them anywhere else. They just kept clearing, kept working. We think that there should be a stop work order or temporary restraining order issued to stop this, make sure that they can clean up the aquifer, because this plume of contaminants is moving through the aquifer, and you can't contain these spills inside of a karst aquifer. That's the danger of not only the construction, but later the pipe is there, the loss of condensate, these chemicals that are in the pipeline could contaminate the aquifer and maybe permanently never be able to clean it up.
Yes, everything that David has provided is correct. And I want to also add to the habitat destruction that's occurring here. And it's not just on the surface, as we've just maintained. This is a karst region. And in the Blanco River Valley and the Trinity and the Edwards formations here, what we mean by that, and if I'm sorry, I can't give you an illustration, but when you go into this area where we live, you can see the Blanco River, and you can see very prominent features like Jacob's Well. What we can't see, but we know is there throughout this entire region, and this is all along the pipeline easement, Bob. We've got all types of fissures, cave openings, seeps. We have springs. We have creeks that are moving through, and we have all kinds of recharge sites that are not necessarily the major ones. We know where they are and they're mapped. But I can tell you as a personal example on our property, you know, we've got outcroppings. We have seeps. I've got recharge features. I mean, all the things that are indicative of, and my property is not special. This is typical. And this is why this is so egregious for this company to pick this route to build this incredibly large pipeline when there are more reasonable and much safer alternatives. And that's what we're concerned about. And that from TESPA's side, also, that's why we're working with WVWA and other landowners in the legal actions that we're taking.
So, David, you mentioned Montana ruling, and then there was apparently a U.S. District Court decision back in February where I guess several municipalities were suing Kinder Morgan. Apparently that one went in favor of Kinder Morgan, was my read of that. Is that correct?
Well, the Montana ruling on the Keystone XL, that has been upheld as of last week and is now going to the Ninth Circuit. The Sierra Club has now filed a suit against Kinder Morgan based on that ruling from Judge Morgan in Montana. And also the Natural Resource Defense Council is working on a suit as well on the Permian Highway Pipeline. So that's in process. The Ninth Circuit will hear arguments and it will most likely could go to the Supreme Court before a final ruling is given. But we believe right now that Nationwide 12 permit is suspended. And the Kinder Morgan should not be doing any construction on this line, not only the crossings, but construction in general. And I think that's one misunderstanding about, they think the aquifer is down hundreds of feet. The aquifer in these karst systems is really at the surface because these conduits connect. Everything that happens on the surface goes underground. And we saw that. So in a way, Kinder Morgan proved us right, what we've been saying all along. When they discharged this drilling fluid, it traveled over 1 mile in a single day and contaminated these wells where it was just dark, muddy sediment coming out of these folks' wells. And these were two doctors that worked in hospice that had no water. And still to this day, we did help them get the tank, you know, so that they could have water. But, you know, they couldn't shower. They couldn't wash their hands. They couldn't do anything. And brings to mind the importance of this drinking water in the Hill Country. These are wells. These aren't filtered through municipal treatment systems. These are direct from the aquifer. And that water is pristine. It's crystal clear and some of the best water in the world. And they've now contaminated it. And we're afraid of what this pipeline, not only just the construction is going to cause damage, but when that pipeline is in there and has these toxic chemicals, that these condensates mixed in with that gas, the potential for a leak, it's not if, it's just when it will leak. And what do we do if someone has no water? They really can't live for even a few days. So
So it sounds like you're referring to this event or this episode in March 28th, was it, in Blanco County?
Yes, that's correct.
And just a little more detail about that was that the fluid that was actually being used in the construction?
It was actually the fluid. And the fluid that was being used as part of this drilling process, and as we said, this was taking place as they were attempting to drill under the Blanco River, that's when the discharge and the contaminants were released into the aquifer that resulted in the wells in the immediate area being contaminated. From that incident, and as David just said, even until now, the Kinder Morgan has still been, for some reason, just very reluctant. They have acknowledged that this event occurred, but they've really been reluctant to become involved and help the landowners, the well owners out there in the area to do any type of checking of their wells, some ongoing testing, that at least that we're aware of. And that's why on April 8th, TESPA, representing the landowners and also WVWA, this is when TESPA filed our notice of intent to sue Kinder Morgan and the Permian Highway Pipeline Project. And it was specifically for violation relating to this event, violations of the Safe Drinking Water Act, Resource Conservation Recovery Act, and the Clean Water Act.
Now, Hays County recently withdrew its permits for this project. Was that related to the March accident, or was that a separate action?
The county commissioners in Hays County took a separate action, but based to some degree on what happened at the Blanco River, but also have joined with us in expressing concern over what's happening to our county and this area, the Hill Country, by the techniques and the construction and the overall plans of Kinder Morgan. Between the Blanco River, as you move essentially downstream when you're moving from west to east towards Wimberley and then Kyle, in Hays County, there are three county road crossings. And what Hays County did was to inform Kinder Morgan that they were, at this point, they would not be permitted to construct and build the pipeline or drill under these three county road crossings, those three county easements.
And Hays County is also party to a lawsuit that the plaintiffs are the City of Austin, Travis County, Hays County, the City of Kyle, and the Barton Springs Edwards Aquifer Conservation District are suing over the aquatic species, the endangered species you mentioned earlier, the salamanders and seven other species that live in the aquifer where they're going to be crossing there in the Edwards. And so that suit is ongoing, and that's been joined with the suit over the take of the golden cheek warbler habitat. So those two endangered species suits are now joined into one suit. And all those government entities, we've had over 30 government entities file resolutions opposing this pipeline and agencies throughout the region. So we have thousands of people who've signed our petitions. This is not something that's appropriate for this region. And referring back to this discharge, the illegal discharge on the 28th, the initial sampling was done on trace metals. There's also class one carcinogens that were in the drilling gel that's mixed with the bentonite. And these chemicals came back at well exceeding the EPA drinking water standards, including aluminum, arsenic, beryllium, cadmium, chromium, nickel. All of these metals that were in that drilling fluid were contaminated these drinking water wells to a point that they were exceeding safe levels. And when you look online at the pictures of this water, you can't imagine anyone consuming something like that. We're getting reports that that plume is moving. Other people are seeing cloudiness in their wells. So there is testing going on to try to track how far that plume has moved. These are the concerns that we have about this type of construction, this type of industrial infrastructure in such a sensitive environmental area.
I think it's important to note, we talked about Hays County, but our county officials, both elected officials and those, the professionals that are working with us, along with a number of the small cities that are in our region, have all stepped up and are collaborating and working with us, because they're also looking at this from both a short-term and a long-term perspective. Short-term, it's the issues we've just talked about, the direct threat to the aquifer, to our sole source of drinking water, to the habitat of this and the people of this area. In the long term, and this is what county commissioners and others have expressed to me, is this is not what the people in this area want to see now or in the future. This is not the type of activity that is suited for this area of the Hill Country, but it's also dealing with the entire growth issue and how it's going to be managed. And this is what we especially do not want to see in this area because of all the threats and concerns that we have. So we're very pleased that as our nonprofits and our legal team has been working with all our elected officials here, that it's unanimous. They want to work with us and they want to see this changed and sent to another area and have it moved out of this karst region.
Occasionally watch KXAN News in the evening, and they've had a couple stories recently, one about the coating on the pipes that's beyond its expiration date, I believe, and another one regarding public safety officers contracting their services as private security guards. Do you have any comment on that?
Yes, those pipes have been sitting out there for some of them well over a year. The manufacturers say that, you know, they should not be out more than 6 months to maybe 9 months. So they start to corrode in the sunlight from UV rays. So that is an issue. They are technically violating the Railroad Commission's guidelines or rules on that. And the Railroad Commission has filed a notice of violation on the illegal discharge. They went out and measured those pipes and said they were fine. There was no issue with the coating on them. I don't know where that stands now. Kinder Morgan has not complied with many of the requirements in the notice of violation, calling for monitoring plans and revised construction plans.
We're speaking with David Baker and Patrick Cox, environmental advocates who oppose the Kinder Morgan Permian Highway Pipeline. We need to take a short station break, but we'll be right back. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Civil Rights and Wrongs on Co-op 91.7 in Austin, streaming through koop.org. I'm your host, Bob Daly. This evening's program was home-crafted and recorded on May 21st. We're speaking with David Baker and Patrick Cox, environmental advocates who oppose the Kinder Morgan Permian Highway Pipeline. Let's continue.
Part of this process is just that it's not transparent. Let's say this was going to be literally a highway that TxDOT or our local county commissioners were going to build. There would have to be an environmental impact statement. There would have to be public meetings, a long and thorough process of analyzing the kinds of impacts just a road would have, much less putting a pipeline with these toxic substances in it beneath the surface that can explode and has a 1,500-foot blast zone that incinerates everything, as well as the potential for leaking into our aquifer. As far as the public safety officers, I do think using our tax dollars and for their cars and uniforms and their equipment to contract to protect the pipeline is really not the right thing to do. And they should have to hire their own security guards, not use ours. And what we hope the legislature will ultimately do is at least make these pipeline companies play by the same rules that our local governments, that TxDOT, that other agencies have to play by in terms of eminent domain, taking someone's land, private property, without having to abide by the same rules that our local governments have to, is just egregious, and it's unfair. And especially if something as dangerous as this pipeline, there should be a more robust public process. And we believe that the National Environmental Policy Act should apply to these intrastate lines. Because this line claims to be only in Texas, they do not have to do an environmental impact statement. They don't have to do a public process. And if they did, there would be a more robust kind of analysis. And part of that analysis would look at alternative routes that were more safe and less threatening to public health and safety.
Let me provide some more evidence of the things that we're hearing and also what we're seeing. In addition, of course, to the issues that we just discussed, the people here who are actually experiencing the construction and the traffic and the security personnel that are all up and down our highways, this is something no one has ever encountered before. People here have told me that they're accustomed to, as Dave was just talking about, dealing with the highway department on road expansions, dealing with the county on subdivision rules and expansion, dealing with our groundwater districts on establishing rules and procedures for drilling of wells. No one in this area has told me that they've seen, not only they're totally surprised in some instances that this company can go through with this type of procedure and disregarding public safety and the other factors we mentioned, but also there is an expectation they should be following rules, procedures, more of a transparent and open process that lets people know what is the plan, what are the potential risks, what are the damages, and how is this really truly going to be a benefit to the people of this area. So that's what we're talking about in what we'd like to see both the state and federal level to have those factors taken into consideration for corporations like Kinder Morgan that have the eminent domain and condemnation authority.
In the middle of all this, we've got this pandemic. It has demobilized so much of society. Has that slowed down the construction at all? And has it affected your own organizing efforts?
I'll comment on that real quick. No, as a matter of fact, they seem to have accelerated the construction because, again, the accounts that we're getting from people, what I observe when I go out and look at the sites and see how many different crews and how much of an area that they're working on simultaneously. And I've yet to see the construction crews or any of the security people who do often work in close proximity to one another. No one wears masks, you know, there's no distancing requirement. And yet these people are still moving through our community during this COVID-19 period. And I consider that's a risk, that's a public safety issue. And it's just another example of their activities and their disregard for the people who live here and the common sense practices that should be followed.
And Bob, I would say this to me is not a critical infrastructure project. All of this gas is going to be exported to foreign countries. None of this is going to be used domestically. You know, Kinder Morgan has said, oh, no, we are going to sell some of it domestically, but we have no evidence of that. And so to me, this is not a critical infrastructure project. They are claiming it is. They've gotten, you know, exemptions to continue to work. and not only risk their workers' lives, but also potentially threaten these local communities that, you know, these hundreds of workers that are in these man camps and in Blanco and in Gillespie and other counties, you know, from out of state, many of them. And we do not think they should be allowed to be working during this time. And as I mentioned earlier, you know, they have impacted two physicians that were working in hospice and destroyed their water supply, essentially. So this is having a huge impact, and they, not only because of the damage they've caused should they stop, but certainly because of the crisis, they should pause their work and answer some of these questions that we've been asking for almost 2 years now. And there seems to be no oversight or state or federal agency that's willing to really step in at this point.
On the larger national level, and this is on your question about the impact of COVID-19, I think everybody is seeing in the news and the information we're getting the amount of reduction in the use of fossil fuels in particular, just because of the whole change in lifestyle. And it's having a very significant impact on the oil and gas business, in particular, the companies that are associated with the shale gas of the Permian Basin. Kinder Morgan is a publicly traded company. And if you go on and look at their stock and look at their history, the recent history of what's happened to them, the stock has dropped precipitously. They're going to be encountering all kinds of problems. I think that, don't know this for sure, but this may be part of the reason also to trying to accelerate the construction process as rapidly as possible. But they're also trying to take advantage of this period during COVID-19 when people are absorbed with this issue and very concerned. But at the same time, the people that are being impacted with COVID-19, this pipeline issue is just as big, just as serious, and just as damaging.
Last year, the Texas legislature passed and was signed into law what was called HB 3557, which was specifically aimed at opposition to projects like this. Has that affected your activities at all?
Not directly. We believe we have our constitutional right to assemble, to protest, to oppose this pipeline. I think that law would apply if we were on, say, private property that has been acquired by Kinder Morgan in terms of their easement. If we were blocking that pipeline, that law would basically say that we would be, that would be a felony with penalties up to 10 years in prison. We think that is a violation of our constitutional rights. That has not been tested yet. It may be before this is over. We're choosing to use the legal system, and we are, you know, vocally and have been very opposed to this, and we do not think that that law should take our constitutional rights away.
Could you talk about your strategies going forward, next steps? What should we watch for?
Well, I think that we will be filing the suit at the end of the 60-day notice period that addresses the violation of the Safe Drinking Water Act by injecting the fluids underground to the source of drinking water, creating an imminent and substantial endangerment to the public under the Resource Conservation Recovery Act, and discharge of pollutants in violation of the Nationwide Permit 12 issued by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, as well as discharging pollutants into the waters of the United States without a permit. That suit will go forward, and we feel that Kinder Morgan has violated the public trust. What we've witnessed is the worst case scenario. Our biggest fear for the people of Blanco and the Hill Country and the landowners and well owners in the path of the pipeline. It's unsafe and unwise to continue this project through our karst region. So given this failure, we're going to work to secure some kind of resolution that either moves this pipeline, stops it, And we hope that the litigation will provide that outcome for the residents of the Hill Country and send a signal to our legislators that our private property rights, that the safety of the aquifer and our environment and our drinking water is not up for sale, and they need to stand up for the people that they represent, not a corporation like Kinder Morgan that does not apparently care about the lives of these people that they're impacting.
Patrick, anything to add for TESPA there?
Well, that's true. As far as the 60 days of when we filed the clean water actions that we talked about earlier, that will be up next month in June. So our attorneys will be focused on preparing the suit, and they're also will be looking at evidence and incidents that have occurred that help substantiate our case. And we are hearing from more landowners who have concerns and have issues. And it's everything from, you know, damages to the threats to the groundwater. And now we're also hearing about stormwater runoff and the lack of erosion control that's occurring all up and down the pipeline too. So our position is that we will continue to work and focus on our legal initiatives with the court, and also to be working with and watching the rulings and actions of the Corps engineers and the Texas Railroad Commission as well.
People can tell us about what's going on with the Permian Highway Pipeline and our efforts to stop it and to move it. So we really appreciate you inviting us to talk to your listeners today, and we look forward to keeping you updated and hopefully protecting this water by stopping this pipeline.
If people wanted to contact you folks, you've got websites, right?
Yes, we do. TESPA is tespatexas.org. And David?
Yeah, like I said, savethehillcountry.org and then wimberleywatershed.org. So either of those sites, you can send us an email, and there's phone numbers to contact us. We're happy to talk. And certainly if there's landowners out there that are seeing changes in their water in terms of clarity and taste or smell, to contact us and let us know. We've also got resources there for landowners that want to get their water tested, just to have a baseline before this, you know, any more construction or anything else happens.
I want to thank both of you for joining us here this evening. This is very informative. We'll be following your progress. So thanks for joining us.
Bob, thank you very much, and we appreciate the opportunity. And please stay in touch, because this story is evolving and is of great concern to all of us. Thank you.
We've got a few minutes remaining this evening. Time to check in with Austin Sanders, staff writer for the Austin Chronicle. Austin covers City Hall, AISD, and several other areas as well. This is Friday, May 22nd. Hey, Austin, thanks for joining us.
Hey, Bob, thanks for having me again.
So I heard there was a city council meeting yesterday. Anything interesting happen?
Yeah, so they, for one, approved a number of contracts that would essentially use the remaining $7 million balance in the RISE fund. This is, you know, something we had talked about a few weeks ago when council first passed it, a $15 million economic relief fund that was going to be distributed to various nonprofit organizations, social service providers, to basically help people who either could not access the federal stimulus or, frankly, who would just need more help. So the city council approved the remainder of those contracts to disperse the rest of that money. So that fund is now depleted.
Is that $15 million the end of it then, or?
Yeah, we're not totally sure at this point. Another action that the council took is they approved the acceptance of $170 million in federal aid from the CARES Act passed by Congress that basically, you know, distributes dollars to municipalities to help in the pandemic response. And the city is still working through how they intend to use that money. The city's deputy budget officer presented to city council Tuesday a kind of preliminary framework for how that money should be spent. Basically, there's a few different buckets that it would go into: public health, economic support, emergency response, and kind of a contingency fund. So if the pandemic drags out longer, if there's a surge in cases, things of that nature, will have some money to deal with. And when council was hearing this presentation afterwards, some of the council members floated the idea of using some of the federal money to replenish the RISE fund, because we've seen really unprecedented demand for that money. And one organization I've talked to regularly about this, Catholic Charities of Central Texas, they were receiving thousands of calls within days of opening applications for their RISE fund. They actually had to establish a new phone system. So there's definitely some interest on council of replenishing the RISE fund, if not replenishing it, at least using the federal money to do some of the same things that the RISE fund did. So provide rental assistance or direct cash assistance or help people pay for food or diapers, different things of that nature. It seems like the city will certainly be using the $170 million, some of it toward those ends as well.
That's really encouraging. You know, when we talked about the RISE Fund some weeks ago, I just had this feeling that $15 million, while it may sound like a lot of money to some people in a city this size, I imagine that would be used up very quickly.
Yeah, absolutely. And council, you know, they said as much when they passed the resolution creating the fund, that, you know, they acknowledged that $15 million, you know, exactly like you said, it seems like a lot, but the amount of need is so great. You know, employment numbers came out again today from the Texas Workforce Commission. And if I recall, there was something around 12% was the unemployment rate in the Austin metro area, which is significantly higher than what has been in the last several years. So obviously, yeah, the need far exceeds what the city is capable of doing, which is how this congressional aid, $170 million, how that will be distributed is really important. And I should say, the city is getting grants and other funding to a total of about $270 million that will be distributed for those three buckets I mentioned. The $170 million is specifically from the CARES Act, what they're getting.
You mentioned also that apparently there was some directive given to the city managers about bringing people back to work safely. That was for city employees?
No, this is kind of broadly for employers throughout the city. It's one of these resolutions that, because it's not just for city employees, there's not a lot of teeth to the resolution. There's not really, you know, anything the city can do to, you know, require a business to enact some of these standards, but the city can play an educational role. They can advocate, they can teach workers how to advocate and inform of resources, things of that nature. But yeah, this resolution was introduced by Councilmember Greg Kassar. And basically, yeah, it tasks the city staff with creating a unified strategy for protecting high-risk workers as more and more businesses reopen under Governor Abbott's Open Texas plan. So some of the things that the resolution says staff should look for are ways to promote telework. So people who don't have to come to an office or a workplace, allow them to work from home. If that's not possible, improve working conditions to make them safer, you know, space people out at least 6 feet, provide hand sanitizer and plenty of soap, face masks if possible, just these kind of provisions that can make a workplace safer. And then the resolution goes on to list some other things like educating people on how they can get tested for COVID, if they have to stay home from work, how they can apply for unemployment insurance, or how they could apply for some of the RISE funding from some of these different nonprofit organizations. So it's kind of a multi-pronged, almost like a public awareness campaign that the city would be embarking on to raise awareness about how employers can make workplaces safer for high-risk employees, and how employees themselves can better advocate for themselves, because You know, one of the big concerns that Kassar and others on council expressed is some workers, obviously, you know, they have to go to work. You know, they not be able to live on the amount of unemployment benefits, or they may not qualify for them if they're undocumented or perhaps living with someone who's undocumented. So there's people who are, you know, reluctant to stay home from work because they would lose access to wages. And the city wants those people to know that there are resources available to them if they decide to stay home because it's safer, or if they're sick and need to stay home out of, for, you know, to protect their health and the health of their coworkers.
Shifting just a little bit, some months ago, one of our guests was Matt Malika, the director of Austin Echo. And we talked about this point in time count that was made of homeless people back in January. And we've been waiting for the numbers to come out. And I guess they were just released about a week ago or so. What do you know about that?
This was, you know, another delay due to COVID-19 case. Typically, the results are available just a couple of months, 2 to 3 months after the count, which occurs every January. Matt, I'm sure, told you it's federally mandated. It's the census of, you know, a city's homeless population. And what we learned from the results in Travis County is that overall, we saw an 11% increase in the number of people experiencing homelessness who were counted. And I put emphasis on counted because what the point in time count is it's really a snapshot of homelessness. A lot of people look at these numbers and think it's a completely accurate accounting of every homeless person who lives in an urban area, but that's just not the case. If you think about the process of the point in time count, it happens on one night of the year between 3 a.m. and 9 a.m. in January, and this year it was January 25th. Volunteers are only counting people that they can actually see. So you may see a tent or evidence that someone is living without shelter, but if you don't actually see that person, you can't count them as part of the census. So there are certainly limitations on those numbers. But what it does say is it's one data point. It's a way to get a grasp on how many people are experiencing homelessness in an urban area. So we have that 11% increase. A much bigger increase was in the number of people counted living without shelter. That was up 45% over the 2019 count. Pretty significant increase there. And there are a few different factors that Echo points to. One, the city's changes to public camping ordinances, which basically had drawn people experiencing homelessness out of the outskirts of our communities, out of wooded areas, into more public spaces where they feel safer. Obviously, they have access to more resources. They're more visible to the public, which is certainly a double-edged sword. But for the most part, it's brought more people into the light, so to speak, and has increased in visibility and safety. Two of the downtown shelters, the Arch and Salvation Army, they transitioned their model to what's called housing-focused model, which means they are a little stricter on who can sleep at their shelters, but it's because the people who are sleeping at their shelters are engaging in case management. They're actually working on a housing program to get permanently housed, to exit homelessness. Those factors combine to essentially increase the amount of unsheltered people counted on January 25th as part of the point in time count, according to Echo. So we did see some increases, but it's important to put those increases in context, one with how the point in time count actually works and its limitations and what that means, and how some of the shifts in strategy that the city and Echo are taking toward, you know, shifting to our new strategy to reduce homelessness, how those changes could impact the point in time count.
Just to wrap this up, there was a resolution regarding APD body cameras. What happened there?
So basically, this is something, it was a new policy released by the Austin Police Department that they've been working on with community groups and the Office of Police Oversight since 2018. And it basically regulates the rules under which the department would release body cam video from critical incidents, which there's a variety of incidents that fall under that umbrella, which if people go to AustinChronicle.com, they can read my story for more details. The chief has 60 days to release a critical incident, and it could be body cam, dash cam, bystander video, all kinds of video to the public. If for some reason the chief says we can't release this, it's part of an active investigation, or it would put someone in the video at risk, the chief has 45 days to explain himself, basically, to say, this is why we're not releasing the video. We understand there's public interest, but this is why we can't release the video. So it's a pretty significant change. Farrah Muscadin, the director of OPO, really celebrated the implementation of this policy. It's something her office has worked on since 2018. It's finally in place, and APD has told me that the Michael Ramos body cam video from the fatal shooting of Michael Ramos on April 24th, that will be the first body cam video that's released under this policy. In the near future, we should be seeing what this policy actually looks like in practice.
Well, that's a lot. Wasn't expecting quite all that much activity out of City Council, so really appreciate the wrap-up. We'll have to get you back on here again.
Sure, I'm always happy to come back on.
Well, that's all for this evening. Please join us next week when Michael Barajas from the Texas Observer returns to discuss COVID-19 in Texas prisons. Stay tuned for Roots Train with Dale Smith coming up next. Have a good evening, everyone, and stay safe.